Well, good afternoon, everyone. The Committee on Ways and Means will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. Members, I don't know if we're going to have a quorum or not. I don't know who will make it here on December 1st and who won't make it, so I'm just going to proceed. We're going to today review the Minnesota budget forecast that was released yesterday, but before I do, let me just say it's good to see all of you who I haven't seen for a very long time. I hope you've been having a restful interim after being here a lot longer than we all expected, and I wish you a happy holiday season.
Thanks in general, thanks.
Yeah.
With that, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Welcome back, Commissioner, Dr. Stinson. I don't know which of you wants to start out, but go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for inviting us to come and talk about the forecast that we just announced and released yesterday. I think you should have in your packets a packet of charts, and that's what we'll be mainly going through and using. As well, you should have a summary of the actual forecast book. And, Mr. Chairman, members, I would recommend we have a longer version of that forecast book in more detail out on our website. And there's some useful information that I would recommend that that you read for more enlightening information about the economy, actual revenues, and particular areas of spending. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I don't think that there's a lot here that's news, but I will certainly go through things kind of quickly and invite you to jump in with questions at any time. The first chart in your packet, at the bottom of page one, shows the actual news in the forecast, and this really encapsulates the entire story here. Forecast is up. In the current biennium of 607, $701 million is the balance that's forecast. This is roughly 2.3% of the overall budget, and it's largely on the revenue side of the budget where we're exceeding the previous forecast. And then the next point to note is that balance is automatically allocated in current law towards buying back the school payment shift. No further action is necessary for that to occur, and the payments beginning in December 15th, in just a couple of weeks, a lot of this money will be going out to school districts. Next, the bottom part of the chart gives you some information about the closing of fiscal year 2005. Much of this information was largely reported. We reported in our July economic update that we had nearly $300 million in excess revenues over forecast when we accounted for final payments and liabilities and refunds for tax year 2004. And again, now we've included all of the closing with the expenditure data as well. And so that leaves $337 million. In total, that was the balance at the end of the previous biennium, and by law, that money goes into a tax relief account. Now, unlike the school payment shift, there's no automatic action that has any spending out of that account, so the tax relief account is for our budget purposes, sitting there on our statements looking like and acting like a reserve. Take some action of the legislature before anything happens with that money. Next, the chart on the top of page 2 is just a little bit more information about the fiscal 2005 closing. As you can see, the $298 million variance in revenues, which I mentioned we had reported in the economic update in July, largely those final payments in income tax year 2005 or 4. There's a change in spending for the fiscal year 2005, savings of about $67 million over what we had previously reported at the end of the legislative session. But in fact, when you account for the carry forward of funds, because there was authority to carry forward spending from fiscal 2005 to 2006, the real change in spending is actually only about $14 million when those two are netted together. So you see that ending balance of $337 that goes into the tax relief account. Then the chart on the bottom of the page, page 2, shows you fiscal year 2006-2007. and the various categories that account for that change and that variance. The beginning balance, you'll note, is actually the 337 plus the carry forward of $53 million. So, in fact, that $53 million doesn't really change the bottom line because the resources and the authority to spend them carry forward. But that's included in that beginning balance. Then you can see the revenues here, nearly $700 million, which, again, this accounts for almost the total change in the forecast on the revenue side of the picture. And Tom Simpson will talk a little bit later about the makeup of those revenues. The spending changes shown here at $78 million are actually, if you reduce the carry forward, $53 million from that, you get really about a $25 million change in spending, which is really pretty modest. And as you know, Mr. Chair and members, most of the appropriations, when we do a forecast, most all of the appropriations are fixed. The ones that are variable in a forecast are in the entitlement programs like Health and Human Services and the health care programs, as well as we look at updated numbers for actual student counts in K-12 education, and also debt service is somewhat of a variable in the forecast. So most other, all other areas are remaining the same. Then you can see that tax relief account is now showing in this biennium as $317 million. In fact, there was a $20 million appropriation out of this account in the tax bill this last session. So we carried forward the $337 in the tax relief account, but in this biennium there's a $20 million appropriation. So the balance that's available in the tax relief account is $317 million. And the chart here shows the balance of $701 million before allocation, because now, in fact, that $701 million will be allocated to the school payment shift and will be reflected in spending. So you'll actually see this $701 million added to the spending for this current biennium. So when you're looking at making comparisons from biennium to biennium about spending growth, this makes a significant difference in that total spending. And again, just to remind you that the balance at the end of the legislative session for this biennium was actually $12 million. So the improvement is $689 million, and that entire balance of $701 million gets allocated toward the school shift. And the chart at the top of page 3 goes into a little bit more detail about the school payment buyback for the school shifts. That, and just to remind you that previously, in the previous two forecasts, we began buying back the shifts and actually spent $268 million between last February and then the previous November's forecast, began buying back the payment shifts. And then that next bullet point talks about the school aid payment shift, and that is now completely bought back. But this is where we pay, the goal is to pay 90% of the entitled funds to school districts in the current year and a 10% settle-up. After the 2003 session, we were actually at an 80% in the current year and 20% in the following. We began partially buying that back, and now it's completely bought back. So beginning with the December 15th payment, we'll be on this 90-10 schedule for school districts. The other shift is the property tax recognition shift. And this was at 48.6%, and now more than three-fourths of that shift has been bought back. This is where we talk about setting our state aid by telling districts how to recognize, to actually accelerate the recognition of the revenues that they receive from their property tax and levies and referendum levies. So that to actually complete that shift, we would need another $94 million. So we're getting close to buying back that shift, but not completely yet.
Representative Briley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Simpson, I'm just yesterday, I think you said that, or I'm sorry, Ms. Ingeson. I'm dyslexic, you know. Yesterday, I think you said that on December 15th, the schools would get a sizable payment, is what I had written down here. When this is a forecast, how do you estimate exactly what they would get so we don't overshoot the mark, and then when do they get the rest of it?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling, the payment schedule for the school aides is set pretty specific in statute. So the payments go out the 15th of each month and the last day of each month. And then there's a percentage of the total that districts are entitled to. So that December 15th payment will be sizable because it actually makes up for all of the payments this fiscal year, bringing them all up to the 90%. So that's a sizable payment. And again, I would say that, yes, this is a forecast, but the law requires that on the basis of a forecast, we make these payments back to school districts. So there is actually a schedule, and I know that the Department of Education is actually working on a schedule that will be district by district, what districts can expect in the remaining payments for this fiscal year. And so that those aid payments will, you know, in spite of the fact that this is a forecast and we have not yet collected all of this money, we will be adjusting payments as if this is what we're going to collect through the remainder of this biennium.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, following up on that, you said there's $94 million left that we need to pay off the property tax recognition shift. Is there any rounding involved in that? I know we had a provision this last year that we added in that said that we were rounding it to the nearest tenth of a percent so that we didn't have this really difficult calculation. Is there some amount of money sitting out there that is affected by that rounding?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. If our current, we're actually going to use of the $701 million, $330.7 million, and I think that is kind of getting to this calculation of now getting that property tax recognition shift to 10.8%. But I don't know if it means that there's a, you know, portion of $1 million or so. Oh, thank you. Jim Showalter just advised me that there's about $300,000 that is left there because of the rounding to the nearest tenth of a percent.
So I mean, if we use that, so you're kind of saying we really have $93.7 million to go. I mean, if we want to be really exact about it.
Well, maybe, Mr. Chair, unless the 94 takes that into account, which I'm...
Okay. All right. Well, I know we had a lot... I guess back when we were dealing with the payment shift in that rounding, it amounted to several million dollars, and it's less, I guess, with the property tax recognition shift. So, okay, thanks. Please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, there's a chart on the bottom of page 3 that just talks a little bit about the spending, and I wasn't going to go into too much detail about the changes in the forecast related to spending because they are very modest. One thing I would just point out is that the place where the percent was the most sizable but still less than 2% of a change is actually in the tax aids and credits. And just to clarify that this is actually where that $55 million change or increase in spending, this is where we're carrying the interest payments on the Hutchinson Technology case refund. So there's another chart a little bit later that talks about the Hutchinson Technology case and the effect that that's having, because to remind you, there was a Supreme Court final decision made this last spring about that tax case, and in June the Department of Revenue made an estimate about the revenues that would likely be lost or refunds that are due as a result of that case. And that information has now been incorporated in the forecast, and it has a couple of parts. One part is the loss in revenues, and the other part is the interest payments that are made, because when we pay refunds that were due previously, they're entitled to receive interest payments on that. So that interest payment shows up as an expenditure, and so that $55 million in the tax aids and credits change is incorporating the interest payments on the Hutchinson Technology. In all of the other areas, you can see the percents are 1% or less, and they're fairly modest, but there's a little bit of activity going on in both the K-12 education and health and human services, a little bit in debt service, but if anybody has specific questions about those, we can talk further. Mr. Chair and members, I want to talk to you a little bit about the chart on the top of page 4, and this is our planning estimate or our outlook for 2008-2009. And you'll recall that when we do a forecast and we do a budget, one of the things that we try to do to responsibly assure that we're living within our means is to take account of the effect of continuing with the current law, revenues and expenditures, and looking at the effect in the following biennium, and just roughly or generally being able to see that we've got revenues and spending in balance. There's been a fair amount of contention about the fact that the forecasts do not include inflation on expenditures, and we agreed after lots of discussions last year that we would prominently display the effect of inflation. As you can see from this chart, we're showing the difference between revenue and expenditures in the line in about the middle of this chart, and there's been a great deal of improvement since the end of session there. I think it's close to a $600 million improvement in the numbers there. And we're also showing the effect, as we committed to do, of inflation on expenditures. The rates that we're using that are forecast in this forecast from Global Insights are 1.7% in fiscal 2008 and 2.2% in fiscal year 2009. So the dollars that you see then subtracted are the effect of the inflation. Another thing, Mr. Chair and members, that we wanted to do is to just kind of fully disclose the other thing that we know is out there, and that is the constitutional amendment that is going to be on the ballot in November 2006 that dedicates the remaining portion of the motor vehicle sales tax that's in the general fund, dedicates that to transportation purposes, and it's a phased-in approach. But this would show the effect if that amendment were to pass, that this would be a loss of revenues in the general fund. And Mr. Chair and members, what we're very pleased about in this forecast, in the big part of the good news, is that even taking these things into account, we're seeing a positive balance between revenues and spending in that planning estimate. And Mr. Chair and members, this is a standard that we had some years back, and when we've been in trouble these last few years with our finances, we've had to abandon those standards, and so we wanted to show that here, that we've returned to that, feeling really good about the fact that we've restored the reserves and the cash flow accounts, bought back for the most part the school payment shift, not totally, but also kind of restored some balance between revenues and expenditures in our planning estimates.
I'm sorry, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Ingeson, you've got the amount listed for inflation for fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 09. What would be that amount for if you were looking at comparing it to the $701 million there?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling, I think you're... let me just kind of clarify the question that you're asking me, and I'll tell you, I'm sorry to say someone asked me the question yesterday, so I should have been better prepared today to answer the question, but I think you're asking me what would be the effect of including inflation on expenditures in the current biennium?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'm sorry, I don't know. I did not calculate that. The actual rate of inflation in fiscal year 2006 and 2007 in the biennium that we're in is higher than the rates that were projected in 2008 and 2009. But in fact, I did not calculate that. I'll tell you we don't make adjustments for that automatically in the forecast. I would say some of the it certainly is an indication with the higher inflation that there's more pressure on agencies and budgets to live with the dollars that they currently have. The inflation rate is actually, in this forecast, goes up in 2006 and goes down in 2007, partly because of the expectation that oil prices are going up, but they're expected to come back down. So again, that's an area where there'd be pressure on budgets, but I haven't calculated that, what that percentage would be. And again, Mr. Chair and Representative Gravely, we don't make adjustments automatically for that in the forecast. there are some things that may be akin to inflationary adjustments in some of the forecast programs, such as in Health and Human Services, where there's expectations that costs of care will go up. Those are somewhat built into the forecast.
Representative Riley.
Commissioner, could you get me that? Because I was just trying to figure out if we had added it and how much money then we would have. I mean, we're paying back the shifts, and you know, I think that's really a good place to put it. But then I'm wondering if we really are able to cut other areas if we pay back the shifts and then we don't account for inflation. So I know Mr. Stinson yesterday said it would be 3.5 in fiscal year 06. So I could calculate it out, I guess, too. But I'll
do that. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Garland. This question came up yesterday, and I should have been prepared for that and calculated it. I'm sorry I didn't do that.
Thank you.
I'll get to Representative Wagini in a minute, but just so I understand Representative Reiling's question, Commissioner, or Representative Reiling, I guess what you're saying that even though we have a budget set for the 2006-2007 biennium, you're trying to determine how much additional inflation there would be, if any, over and beyond the budgeted amount we've already set for fiscal year 2007, Representative Reiling?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to find out how much inflation would factor in here, because we've got it listed for the 08-09 budget outlook, but I don't have it for 07, for instance, or 06-07, so I guess that would be right.
Okay, because I guess in the past when we've always said, well, we've set the budget for 06-07, we've made a determination to cover whatever expenditures we thought were necessary for 06 and 07. And so you're saying you felt that we should have spent more in 07, and you're using the inflation number as a way to determine what you thought that number should be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to find out what inflation would be, because if we have numbers set, if there's inflation above and beyond that, then it seems I just like to know what that is. So how much ground are we losing by inflation? I don't know what that would be.
Okay, and I was just trying to understand where you were going. I'm presuming we've, in theory, taken that into account in setting the budget. But I understand now where you're going. Commissioner, do you have a comment to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I. To be clear, the inflation rate, the CPI rates that are in this forecast for fiscal 2006, 3.5% in 2006 and 1.56% in 2007. And Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling, I think the tricky part of answering your question is what we really need to be looking at is what changed in inflation, in the rates of inflation since the budget was set, because presumably we had anticipated some level of inflation in the budget. I know certainly there were increases that we could say in K-12 education, which were partly related to inflation. So we wouldn't, you know, I think what you might be getting at is trying to estimate or identify how much more inflation is there now than when we set the budget and what we knew about, because we did. For example, there were several areas where there were rate increases that were expected to be COLAs or reflecting inflation. And so the portion of that we want to be talking about is how is this inflation rate that's currently projected different from the rate that was projected at the time we set the budget? And that rate was... Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Reiling, that I don't have these inflation numbers in fiscal year. They're in calendar years. But for calendar year 2006, when we set the budget, the rate was 1.6%. It's now 2.6%. So there's a, you know, 1% difference there. In calendar year 2007, the rate when we set the budget was projected to be 2%. it's now 1.5%. So it's actually lower in fiscal 07. Again, those are calendar years, so you get some rough idea of the relationship there between the calendar year and fiscal year. So there's, you might say that there's, less than 1% difference, because we've got about 1% higher in the first year and 0.5% lower in the second year. So I think the way that we look at inflation, we say it's pretty close. There's obvious particular areas in the CPI where there's going to be pressure. Agencies that have, as part of their budget, spend a lot of their money on fuel costs, for example, certainly will be feeling some more pressure in this current biennium.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final comment. I still would like if you could calculate out the exact numbers for me, I would appreciate that, because it gets very confusing to me, not to mention, to my constituents and the public, when we don't, we talk about a 4% increase for schools each year on the formula, but that didn't include inflation, and, it gets very complicated. So I would just like, the difference, if you could calculate it out, that you said you would do, I'd appreciate that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, I'm trying to think about how you might expect me to calculate that. If you just were to look at the expenditures for the current biennium that have been set, that in fact did include inflation in some areas, and I think when you suggested that there was a 4% increase in the education formula but no inflation, my expectation was that 4% included inflation. Actually exceeded inflation.
I would think, Commissioner, going back to the way you were talking, what you would do is you'd go back to Global Insights inflation forecast for the upcoming quarters, look at what it was in the February forecast for the next fiscal biennium, look at what it is for this biennium, look at what it is now in this forecast, compare them and do a calculation and see if there is more inflation than was expected and how much more that is. I mean, that would seem, going along with what you were saying before, that would seem to me to be the thing that would make the most sense, because, as you were saying, some areas like education, we did give an increase that, at least to me, I thought included inflation. But I guess, Representative Greiling, that may not be what you want. So I guess let me let you respond, and if you have a different feeling, ask the commissioner to do the calculation you want.
Mr. Chair, I can maybe talk to her afterwards, not to tie up everybody else's time, but, it, like I said, it gets confusing, because last year when we had this similar thing, we didn't have the inflation factored in, and then we give increases to schools, but it wasn't based on, it was based on not having that there. So, when we have one year that's different from another, it's what gets hard. And so I'll have to reconcile it in my own mind, but I will talk to Ms. Ingerson afterwards.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had more questions about inflation part of them you've answered, but you went over the assumption for 08 and 09 fairly quickly, and I didn't have a chance to write these down.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, the inflation rate for fiscal year 2008 is 1.7%, and for 2009 it's 2.2%.
And if I could follow up?
Representative Wagenius, sure.
Were there changes in those two projections?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I think that the rates for fiscal year 2008 was closer to 2%, maybe a little above 2%, and it was pretty close to the same amount for fiscal 2009. Yes, Mr. Chair, that was right.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that would be very helpful when we do this exercise next, and we'll be doing it not too long from now, is if we can have those inflation assumptions on this printed,
The rate.
Yes. The assumptions, what we have assumed and what we are now assuming would be very helpful, because without that, clearly, inflation, it's clearly meaningless. until we know exactly what rates you're assuming. Secondly, as Representative Breiling was talking, I was thinking the question I have had about inflation is really more not macro but micro. People want to know what did we assume about the cost of health care in schools? One, what did we assume about the cost of heating or all, probably all energy in schools? And how is that going to be different now? So when we're asked the question, and that's, I think that is going to be one of those things that's going to be asked again and again, does what we put out there really being eaten up by inflation in these two categories or not? And I think that's a question that's going to be repeated and repeated. So it would be helpful if you did a calculation for us that would help us in that regard.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I think certainly we would try to explain what assumptions may have been as much as we might have been aware of them. We don't make specific assumptions about what school districts would be paying for health care, for example, and or heating fuel. And I would venture to guess that many districts have used actually different assumptions. And so I'm not sure that if there's broader statewide information that we could provide on that basis. We can certainly look at broader assumptions in the economic models that make those assumptions, but I'm not sure that they're realistic when you get to that macro level or micro level.
Representative Forginius.
We might not be able to address school by school, and I'm not asking you to do that, but I think for us to have some sort of feeling of the relativity of the numbers, it would be important to have a number that, in general, we thought heating was going to be here and take up this much of the budget, but now we think heating is, and lights and all that's going to be involved here, is here, and it's going to take up this much of the budget. Not specificity that I think you think I was asking for. I'm not looking for that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, but Representative Wagenius, I guess what I'm saying is that generally when we look at things, we use inflation as a very general number, and we don't look at specific categories in the inflation to say, you know, postage went up, heat went up, that kind of thing. I think we use the general rate of inflation, and I think what we might be able to do is see where things have actually increased over the general rate if there are broad categories of expenditures. You know, again, there could be things that end up actually growing slower than the general rate. And we could, you know, talk about some of the things that we may be aware of that exceed the general rate of inflation. As we're talking about in this forecast a little bit as it relates to fuel and what has happened with fuel costs. And there's a lot of information that we're including here about that.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be able to address what Minnesotans are talking about, and they're talking about fuel. So perhaps we can't do everything. But we did make some sorts of assumptions that are clearly out of whack right now, and they're probably big out of whack. So it would be helpful, and I appreciate that.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, I'm actually, after another slide, going to turn this over to Tom Stinson, and he has some slides and some information about some of the energy costs that I think will be helpful in understanding how far things are out of whack, as you say, Representative Wagenius. Mr. Chair and members, there's a chart that I'm not sure if it's in your packet. It's not in your packet. This is just one of the things I wanted to show this chart because we've talked a little bit about our financial statements, and in fact, we are just completing and will have available, I think probably tomorrow, our audited financial statements
for fiscal year 2005. I've talked a little bit about how we budget. Our budget statements are prepared on a modified cash basis, and our financial statements are prepared on a modified accrual basis. And we get to talking about this gap, if you will. And when we do our financial statements and we're preparing those according to generally accepted accounting principles, we're actually accounting for some liabilities in the financial statements that aren't reflected similarly on our budget statements. And this is one of the things that we, and maybe for an example, it would be the school payment shifts. And I guess I talk about this because in fact, again, emphasizing the importance in our financial statements to buying back those school payment shifts. When we have the liability to school districts with the payment shifts, we have to reflect that in the liability on our financial statements. And that was, in large measure, one of the things that caused us to go to a significant deficit in our financial statements on a generally accepted accounting principles basis. And you can see in fiscal year 2002 we had, almost $800 million in a balance on our financial statements. And then in 2003, both because of depleting our budget reserve cash flow account and beginning the school shift payments, got to have a nearly $1 billion deficit. And I'm talking about this here because this is, in fact, the very thing that the Moody's rating agency pointed to when they downgraded the state's credit rating. And these financial statements are the things that the rating agencies particularly look at because it allows them to make comparisons on a similar standard and criteria across states. And one of the things as well, as you can see here then, in fiscal year 2004, we improved but still showed a deficit on our financial statements, and that was largely because we began restoring the reserves and the cash flow account. Now again, in fiscal 2005, we did begin to buy back a portion of the payment shift, $268 million, and that shift buyback that we're doing now will improve that situation further. But showing here, we've got just under $100 million in positive balance in our financial statements. And one of the things that the Moody's rating agency mentioned in a write-up of our rating on our bonds at our last bond sale was that in order for the state to return to a AAA rating, we would need to show positive balances on our financial statements in a sustained manner. And I guess to just emphasize here the importance of buying back the shifts, there are some things that, I want to be clear that just getting to this point doesn't mean that we're going to get back to getting the AAA rating. It takes a sustained period before the rating agencies would likely be considering an upgrade. But just wanting to point out the importance. And we've talked a little bit about the things that impact this gap balance. We also are showing those liabilities for the Hutchinson Technology case as liabilities on our financial statements, again, contributing to the difference here in a positive balance. Mr. Chair and members, if there's the balances that we had when we closed the year in 2005, like the tax relief account balance, is incorporated into this. So if there's spending of that, that sort of takes away from this positive balance. And so there's a number of factors, but I just show you this because it's another area where we've began to make some progress. We, again, hope to see that improve as we move forward here. Mr. Chair and members, with that, I'm going to turn things over to Tom Simpson to talk a little bit about the revenues and some of the economic changes.
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, at the bottom of page 4 is a chart that shows where the revenues, where the additional revenue came from. There was almost $700 million in additional revenue, and really came from four sources, each of them roughly the same size, although their percentage differences were quite different. There was $188 million more in individual income tax payments, 1.4%, or the individual income tax forecast, 1.4%. Most of that came about not because of an improvement in the economic outlook, but because tax year 2004 liability appears to have been higher than we thought at the time in February. That then adds to the base and carries forward. Sales taxes are up $173 million from forecast, a very small 1.9% change in the forecast, basically reflecting a little bit stronger than expected receipts over the last quarter. The corporate income tax, on the other hand, while it was up $165 million, was up a huge percentage, 11%. But if it hadn't been for the Hutchinson Technology situation, it would have been up by probably around $400 million. It's just astounding how much the corporate tax increased. This is not unusual for Minnesota, the federal government corporate tax is increasing at an astronomical rate as it is in most states. It's due to, as you will see in a minute, very high rate of increase in corporate profits over the last year. Motor vehicle sales taxes really didn't change, down just slightly. All other, which includes the estate tax, was up $176 million. A major portion of that was due to one large estate tax payment, I'm told.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think we have some good data here, and it shows that the economy is moving forward. We have, as I heard one person put it yesterday, some silk, and I sure hope we don't have the number of people trying to make a sow zero out of this. I think it is good news. Dr. Stinson, I do want to know how much of the all other is actually the new tax that was placed on tobacco users.
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Viscons, none of the additional tax, or none of the change in the forecast, was due to a change in the new fee that's levied on tobacco. My understanding is that's something that the Department of Revenue produces for the forecast. We don't produce that. My understanding is that there was not enough information on collections at this time to change the estimate.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, go ahead, Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, the total change for this biennium, $694 million, is 2.3% compared to before. Without the large unexpected estate tax windfall, we would have had less than a 2% change in the forecast. For economic forecasts and for revenue forecasts, a 2% change is well within the margin of error that we expect. And so members of the committee and the public in general needs to get used to seeing larger changes in the forecast with very small changes in the economy. 2% of a $10 billion budget, which is roughly what it was when I started doing this, is a lot less than 2% of a $30 billion budget. And, we just have to begin to adjust our thinking that these changes are going to be a lot larger than we might be used to in normal times.
But, Dr. Stinson, you're getting better and better.
I don't know about that. Luckier and luckier. Part of what the reason for the small change in the outlook for revenues is that there was really no change in the outlook for the economy. If you look at this chart here, unless you have really sharp eyes, you can't see that there are two lines on that chart. Now, I know, Mr. Chairman, that you've been in this committee when I put charts up where even almost a blind man could see there was big differences between the lines on the chart. And so when the economy doesn't change very much, you know, you don't have much of the way of a change in revenues. One of the surprises is that the economy didn't change more than it did. We've had higher interest rates. We've had higher oil and higher energy prices. We've had the hurricane, and yet the economy really hasn't changed much. The reason the economy didn't change because of the higher interest rates is because they were in the forecast when we did this in last February. Over the last day or two, there's been some information that's come out that indicates that maybe interest rates are going to go still higher than are in this forecast. If that's true, then that'll be reflected in the February forecast, and that could take a little bit of money out of the forecast. The higher oil prices, there were high oil prices in the forecast, although not as high as they are now, so only part of that change was there. With respect to Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, they actually didn't change the forecast very much. What they did is change the timing of the growth in the forecast. If you look at the chart on the bottom of the page, there are three bars in this chart, and the darker bar is the February forecast. The white bar is forecast in August prior to Hurricane Katrina, and then the gray bar is what is in the forecast in November. These are for half years, not for quarters. And what you can see is in the second half of 2005, it looked like we were poised for a really strong second half of the year. And then the hurricane came and it took some of that growth away, but not all of it. And it was just added to the first half of 2006. And then from that point on, the forecast really doesn't change very much. The other thing that the hurricane did was it increased the uncertainty about the forecast. In February, as you well know, Mr. Chairman, Global Insight has three different forecasts, what they call a baseline forecast, which is a forecast that they think is going to happen, and they have a more optimistic forecast and a more pessimistic forecast. And they assign probabilities to those three forecasts. In February, the probability assigned to the baseline was 60%. The optimistic and the pessimistic both had a 20% probability. Now the probability assigned to the baseline is 55%, slightly less. The probability assigned to the pessimistic forecast is 25%. So Global Insight is signaling that there's a little more downside risk at this point in the economy. The concern normally when people do a forecast is what's going to happen on out into the future, and out into the future means a year from now or 2 years from now or something like that. This time the concern is much more immediate. And if you look at the chart on the top of page six, you can see what the concern that economists have now is. There is expected to be a huge drop in the growth rate for real consumer spending. This huge drop in the growth rate would move it down so that consumer spending would not grow during the fourth quarter, during the period that we're in right now, compared to third quarter. Now, part of that's due to a drop-off in auto sales. Auto sales were unusually high during the third quarter with the promotional activity that went on. But part of it's due just to higher interest rates, and part of it's due to apparently a small pulling back because of concerns about higher fuel costs as well. The real question is whether the growth in the first quarter of 2006, the quarter that will be roughly two-thirds over when we deliver the forecast at the end of February, whether that's going to be sufficient to sustain the economic growth that's in the forecast here or not. that's something that obviously we don't know. Depends in part on what kind of a snapback consumer spending has, but that's something that we will largely know by the time we do the forecast again. And so that will either be there or not.
So, Dr. Simpson, when I look at this chart, let me just see if I understand this. This is the percent change from the quarter a year ago, I assume.
No, Mr. Chairman, no. This is the percent change from the prior quarter. And so, third quarter compared to fourth quarter. So, this is not... It's seasonally adjusted, and it's at an annual rate, but it is comparing the third quarter and the fourth quarter, not four quarters apart. Four quarters apart, the number is 2.7% growth compared to like 3.6%, which is kind of the normal growth that we would see in there.
So, Dr. Simpson, but are you saying then that if I look back to the first three quarters of the year and they're all maybe about 4%, that consumer spending this year will be 12% or more than last year?
No, Mr. Chairman. These are, we're going to get into a topic that I try to teach my undergraduates in macroeconomics a little bit about. It's how you calculate growth rates on quarterly data. Okay. We always, as a convention, always express the growth rate at an annual rate. It's what would be if this continued for a whole year. And in order to get that, when we compare a quarter with another quarter, what we have to do is we have to take that growth rate and raise it to the fourth power, because it's really the compound growth rate for four quarters. And so a 4% growth rate in a quarter is really roughly a 1% growth rate between the prior quarter and the current quarter.
Well, as I look around, I know that everyone would be really interested in an expanded lecture on this if we just had a little more time. But in the interest of getting done by 5 o'clock, I guess we'll just have to delay that till later. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I promise my question isn't going down the percentages line, but just to clarify what SAAR means in your little charts here, that remind me what that means.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, it means seasonally adjusted at an annual rate. So that's what I was telling the chairman, that it's not the quarterly growth rate, it's the annualized growth rate between quarters.
Thank you.
Okay, please proceed, Dr.
Okay, well, that's the concern, and that's something that we'll have some more information about. Now, part of the reason why we're concerned about that is because of energy prices and the energy situation. And at the bottom of page 6, there's a graph, and here's a more updated version of it here, but it doesn't change the implication. This has about 10 more days of data on it than it did before. What it shows is that for natural gas production in the Gulf of Mexico, about 30% of all natural gas production in the Gulf of Mexico is currently shut in. That is, that it is not going. It is not in operation. It is not being sent on shore. Now, why is that? Well, when we think about energy production in the Gulf, we think about those drilling platforms out there, but we don't think about what's under the water, the pipelines that carry the oil and the natural gas from the drilling platform on shore. And when there's a hurricane, the hurricane causes big mudslides and disruption in the sea bottom as well as damage on shore. It disconnects some of those pipelines, and they find them 5-10 miles away just because of the current, some of them buried under mud and things like that. It takes a while to get this infrastructure back in place. The lighter colored line on the graph up on the screen shows what happened during Hurricane Ivan. After 92 days, less than 10% of the infrastructure was still out of commission, and production was not down by 10% at that point. This time, after 92 days, more than 30% of the infrastructure is still down. Now, for oil, it's actually more than that. It's more than 40% of the oil production is still shut in the Gulf. But natural gas is a particular problem for the U.S. because oil can be made up, oil production can be made up by imports, and we can also import refined products. Natural gas production, there aren't really any import possibilities here. 30% of natural gas production in the Gulf is about 6% of total U.S. natural gas production. So at this point, we're running about 6% less in natural gas production than we had if Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita hadn't gone on.
Okay.
What does that mean? Well, it means that natural gas prices are higher than they would be otherwise. They remain about 15% higher than they were pre-Katrina. And if you look at the black dots on this chart, those are last year's prices, and you can see that they're substantially above last year's prices. Yesterday, the natural gas prices were just about 1170. I think they're actually 1185 or something like that. A year ago, they were 650, so it's more than an 80% increase in there. The question, of course, is, what happens? You know, if we have a warmer than usual winter, this isn't going to be a particular problem. If we have a colder than usual winter and that amount of capacity remains shut in till mid-February or something like that, gas prices are going to go up substantially more, and that will cut into consumer spending, and that will act as a brake on the economy. So that's a second piece that we're going to find out a lot more about between now and the end of before we do the next forecast. The next chart that I want to show you is a chart that shows what happened to corporate profits. The forecast for corporate profits went up dramatically, as I indicated, based on this forecast. For corporate profits, we would have had almost a $400 million increase in corporate profits tax, corporate profits tax receipts over the next biennium. That increase is good news, but there are two pieces of news that aren't quite as good you might think about this. One is the GDP accounts came out yesterday, and they said that third quarter corporate profits weren't quite as high as they had thought. So that would mean that that line would come down a little bit more. The second piece of news, which is particularly disquieting, is that we know that in their model, the Global Insight macroeconomic model, they have to have one category that they use to balance out between the income and the product accounts. That category, that place where they plug in a number to make everything add up, is corporate profits. And so next month when they do the forecast, they might not need as big a plugged-in number, and that number could disappear and drop down a little bit. So the corporate profits number is always very volatile. We'll have more information in February, but this is a number that could move fairly dramatically.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, just a question or a follow-up on that. You said may drop a little bit or something akin to that. Do they give you any indication other than that it's going to drop by some degree? Do they give you any data that...
Can we? Do they give us a forecast of their forecast?
Well, I guess I'm in a sense asking that, but when you say it may drop a little bit, I'm not sure exactly what that means, other than I guess you're just alerting us to it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, it could drop the equivalent of $150 million. In Minnesota tax revenues, that wouldn't be a shock off of this $400 million piece that we have here. That wouldn't be a shock. So
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. Dr. Stinson, the what we're seeing here on the corporate profit chart, I'm assuming that's national profits, or is that Minnesota companies that can be taxed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative,
Dr. Stinson,
that's national corporate profits. Now, Minnesota is able to tax anybody that has a presence in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and so that is the appropriate number to have in there. Some people sometimes think about Exxon as being a New Jersey corporation or something like that, but still we get a share of Exxon Mobil's profits.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, when we're talking about corporations, are we talking about C corporations or S and C corporations, or do we differentiate? Do we break S corporations out as personal income tax? How do we do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, this is C corporations, and S corporations are part of the individual income tax.
Okay.
We have a separate law factor that applies to them.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
As I indicated, this is a lot of money. It would have been a lot more if we hadn't been for the Hutchinson Technology decision and the adjustments that we made on the Hutchinson Technology decision. Based on material that the Department of Revenue gave us from June of 2005, we reduced the corporate tax by $232 million for the results of the Hutchinson Technology decision for fiscal 2006 and 2007. And there are also $58 million worth of interest payments in the spending estimates for 2006 and 2007. For 2008 and 2009, we reduced corporate tax receipts by $150 million, and interest payments of $28 million are part of this forecast as well. So you can see that this jump in corporate profits really produced an enormous amount of potential revenue for the state, and without the Hutchinson decision, we would have seen substantially more revenue even than we had.
Dr. Stinson, can I get into this issue just a little bit more? I'm not sure if there's anyone from revenue here, but I guess I asked you this question yesterday. We may want someone from revenue to come up, and I know that last year we passed some language in the tax bill dealing with taxation of corporations, and you had told me that I think that the effect of it was to raise an additional $3 million of revenue. That was what the revenue estimate was, correct?
Mr. Chairman, we used what is in the fund statement, and I think it was $3 million of additional revenue.
Okay. But I also recall a discussion at that time that they felt that that language we passed might have a significantly larger impact on the Hutchinson Technology case. I'm not sure if it was a case where that $3 million was figured before the Hutchinson Technology decision came down or what the situation was, and I guess I'm just trying to get a sense for that. And we have someone from Revenue here. If you could give us your name for the tape, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I think you're referring to the estimate of the law change that was passed last session, and it did have like a $3 million number on it, I believe. And one thing to keep in mind is that that law is only effective for this tax year, the 2005 tax year and beyond. So for us to have any real hard data on the impact of that law change, we won't have those returns filed until probably October 15th of next year. 2006, so, and then it'll take some time to kind of digest that information, but so we won't really have any real hard figures until then. So I guess our number that we estimated in last session and really didn't change, that was actually, even after the court case, we didn't change that figure. There's still kind of a real question mark what impact that law change will have, whether there'd be any taxpayer behavior changes or et cetera. So we actually still think that's a good number at this point.
So, Mr. Manson, that what date was that tax change effective for? January 1st this year or January 1st, January 1st, 2005?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So you're saying we're not going to know about any change there until October of 2006.
Correct. Yeah, that the 2005 tax returns, generally the taxpayers that would take advantage of this tax benefit wouldn't file, and probably with an extension until October 15th of 2006. So that's when they'll actually have the hard data off the returns.
Okay. And I guess I remember seeing that, I mean, hearing estimates that it might be 10 to 15 times that $3 million a year, what that tax effect would actually be in terms of recapturing some of that Hutchinson technology revenue that was lost. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, there are some theories out there that there is what's called a passive investment company, which is kind of a corporation with not much substantial payroll or property, that maybe this law would have an impact on those corporations, and we think it would have, but really it's a real question of what impact it may have. If it totally would eliminate those companies from taking advantage and qualifying as an FOC, it would have a larger impact. But if it doesn't, then it's a question of, you know, maybe the number where we're at is right now. So it just seems to be too soon to actually change that number at this point until we have some better data.
Okay. Any other questions on that subject? Representative Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask you to, either you or the chairman, to specifically tell us which law change you're referring to, because there were several.
I guess maybe Mr. Manson can give Representative Clark the detail on it.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, this was the law change dealing with foreign operating corporations, which would require them to have a substantial amount of property and payroll, at least $2 million of property located in a foreign country, or $1 million of payroll located in the foreign country in order to qualify as a foreign operating corporation.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark.
I remember in Representative Gunther's committee talking about, actually I think it must have been quite an expanded version of this, because it raised a lot more money and then it didn't, you know, didn't pass there. And I'm guessing what we're talking about is a very modified, diminutive version of that. Some of us think of as kind of a scam. And so I'm just wondering, is that what we're talking about? We're talking about a very reduced, change, I guess, in terms of changing the law.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I think there was a couple of different proposals out there. And one proposal, the governor's proposal, just dealt with this specific foreign operating corporation issue. But there was others that went a little further as far as what type of income qualified that flew through these foreign operating corporations and went into some foreign source royalty deductions. And so there was a larger one, also larger proposals out there as well.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's safe to say that we do have a precedent for looking at these foreign operating corporations anyway, and it raised about $3 million. Is that what you're telling?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Manson. Clark, this law would allow us to audit that issue based on the new law, the change in the law.
Well, and Representative Clark, I guess I'm going to be curious to see what happens here, too, because, I mentioned, while it's being booked at $3 million, I've heard estimates it might be $40 million. But it sounds like we're really not going to have a good handle on that till a year from now, anyway. Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Manson, have you seen any change or any results from the contractor withholding?
Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandeveer, I have not asked that question of the department. I don't know if we have any information on that yet or not. That's something I can check in there for you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other discussion of that issue? I'm not sure if it's worth doing at this time, but I'm informed we actually have a quorum, so I can officially call the meeting to order. We are having a meeting. Dr. Stinson, please proceed.
Okay, I have two more things to point out to the committee. First is that one of our concerns, short-term and longer-term as well, is that employment growth in Minnesota just hasn't quite been keeping up with the national average. we thought it might be just because the recession was a little bit more in the U.S., in Minnesota than in the U.S., but if you look from 2003, which is well after the close of the recession, on out, you can still see that we're not growing quite as fast as the U.S. Between the start of 2003 and October, payroll employment in Minnesota grew by 2.4%. Nationally, payroll employment grew by 2.9%. So this is something that we're keeping our eye on. It's not something that has caused a huge change in the forecast or a huge change in the outlook. We now have about 3,000 jobs per month expected to be created in Minnesota through the end of the biennium.
Representative Clark.
Quick question on that. And that employment growth refers to actual quantity of jobs rather than the quality and the wages paid and so on. Is that right, or is it a combination?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. No, this is just the number of jobs created. And so if it's a part-time job, it's counted as one job. If it's a full-time job, it's counted as one job. If it's a highly paid executive job, it's counted as one job. If it's someone working at minimum wage, it's counted as one job. We're concerned about and looking for changes in the structure of wages compared to employment because our job is to forecast what earnings are for Minnesotans, and if there's been a change in the average earning level for Minnesotans or Minnesota employment, that would affect our forecast for withholding and for the income tax. To this point, we haven't seen anything that we can put our finger on that says that the overall quality of employment, you know, that the average job or that the distribution of employment across the wage scale has changed much. Our withholding models continue to produce estimates that are very close to what we would forecast or what we receive, and that it looks like there haven't been any big changes in the composition of employment, but that's something that's obviously a concern for us. One of the things that's been a concern for us, and was quite a concern for us actually, was that it seemed like wages were growing less rapidly in Minnesota than nationally over the last year or so. And in the book, we actually note our concern about that, and we note that one possibility is that the federal national wage growth estimates are going to be revised down. Yesterday, as part of the gross domestic product release, the Bureau of Economic Analysis did revise the estimates of national wage growth in the second quarter down substantially. So it looks like our withholding and our wage growth looks more in line with the U.S. average now after the revised data for the U.S. came out yesterday.
Representative Clark.
Quick follow-up. I happened to catch Art Rolnick commenting, I think, on this issue on the radio. Did you hear his comments?
No. Yeah, this morning or what?
Yeah, this morning. I was just wondering what you thought of his comments, but I guess you didn't hear him. I can't ask you that question. Mm-hmm. He seemed like he wasn't real concerned, and I... Anyway, I'll ask you another time maybe after you've had a chance to...
Okay. You know, I don't think this is... If they asked him whether this or not, I'm sure I could almost quote what Art would say, which is the U.S. economy is very resilient and very strong, and it can handle these kinds of things and so on like that. It's just, from our point of view, we're always comparing how we're doing against the U.S. average.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like we were getting out of line, and yet we have this information that's pretty hard information. Every day withholding comes in, and so we know kind of how much wage growth there's been from the withholding, and so we were a little concerned, and one of the possibilities was that the U.S. numbers would be revised down. It turned out they were.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, when I heard this on the radio, I got a little bit alarmed. I know we seem to be running into a problem that I think is going to really plague us in the next year, and that is where we are mirrored almost exactly with the job growth of the country. We have a very, very low unemployment rate, much lower than the national rate is. And that indicates to me that we don't have enough workers. And then you hear further from the story that came out of this report that the manufacturing sector is really reeling under this. Now, we have gained more jobs than most sectors in the manufacturing sector. However, as everybody knows, we lost more jobs in that sector. But now we have Minnesota companies not being able to accept contracts with companies because we don't have the workers in the manufacturing sector to get the jobs done. We're going to have to figure out some way to get more people to work, more people trained, and I know Representative Clark's anxious to work in the community to do that. But do you see any truth in the fact that as we have fewer and fewer employees, there's going to be competition for those employees, and the wages will be drawn higher because of that competition, kind of using this law of supply and demand?
Dr. Stimson.
Mr. Chairman, so long and complicated discussion. The state demographer, Tom Gillespie, and I have been talking about this issue for a number of years, and more recently, a lot. We've been talking about it. We're actually going to talk about it tonight in Stillwater. And there are complex things going on here. Over the next decade, the number of people entering the labor force is going to decrease pretty dramatically. And in Minnesota, it's going to decrease even faster than the rest of the nation because we don't have quite as many people that are poised just at the ages that will enter the labor force. That's going to cause even more competition. Minnesota is going to have to be even more competitive to attract the workers that are needed there because we don't have this group of people 18 to 24 as a percentage. That group's going to decrease. There's a second issue, and the second issue is whether those people are going to have the skills that are necessary. And if we draw them from out of state, will they have the skills that are necessary? And that's an important issue as well. And there's information that group is not doing as well in terms of skill sets as the people that we were used to being able to bring into the labor force. So that's another complicated issue in there. There's another complicated issue which you bring up, which is will wages increase fast enough to bring people in there? That's really a function not only of the need for workers, but the value of what the worker produces. You cannot stay in business if you're paying a worker $15 an hour and the product that he's making is only worth $12 an hour. It's only valued at $12 an hour. And so there's that competition as well that's going in. To the extent that manufacturing in the state is going to survive, it is not going to survive in the low-wage area. We're just not going to be able to compete with offshore sources in the low-wage area. What we're going to have to do is focus on higher value-added items and items where quality of the product is very important. And those are the things where Minnesota's manufacturing is going to be able to succeed.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, I can't agree with you more. I really look at some radical ideas that have been talked about in the last couple of years, especially lately, of opening our colleges up for reciprocity for everyone in the United States instead of just Minnesotans, South Dakotans, and Wisconsin, people from Wisconsin. They say that once we have someone go to college and graduate here, we have a 47% chance of retaining them in Minnesota. And those are the kind of things we're going to have to do to address the high-skilled people. So we're going to have to do some probably radical things if we're going to try to attempt to match the number of people that industry seems to want to have.
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Stinson,
Representative Gunther, I agree. There's also an important issue that Tom Gillespie and I have been talking about, and that is training of the incumbent workforce, the group of people that are already at work in their more than 80% of the people that are going to be working 10 years from now are already working. And so if we're going to continue to upgrade the skill level of our workforce, which we're going to have to do to be able to compete in a global economy, we're going to have to figure out new and innovative ways of maintaining and increasing the skill level of the incumbent workforce. And also, we're probably going to need to figure out new and innovative ways of maintaining and increasing the working participation of people that are approaching retirement age or are going beyond the traditional retirement age, because that's another important labor resource that we have that we're going to have to draw on.
Please proceed.
Okay. Here are my short-term concerns, and these are really short-term concerns. They're things that we'll know something about by the February forecast. The first is, will the consumer spending snap back the way it's forecast in the book? In an article today in the Star Tribune, Mike Myers talked to David Weiss, who used to be with Data Resources, which is a group that we contracted with. David's now saying he's a little concerned about the first half of 2006, given all that's gone on. Second question really is home heating costs, what effect they're going to have on the consumer spending and the energy supply outlook. Those are both concerns that we'll know a lot more about by February. A third concern that we have may seem a little bit small, but we have $57 million booked of compliance revenue for voluntary compliance, voluntary payments on abusive tax shelters. That money has to show up between now and February. If it doesn't show up between now and February, that creates a hole in the budget as well. And then there's this whole issue of Hutchinson, and here there could be good news or there could be bad news, that the information that we have on Hutchinson at this point is just too weak to base anything on.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, more of a statement rather than a question. On Hutchinson Technology, because the agreement or the bill that was signed, the law, now has payroll and other factors in there. Part of the hit on Hutchinson is what's called passive investment corporation money. And I think the way to describe it to the committee is that a large, let's say, intellectual property firm out of Washington, let's just pick one, will have a company where they put all their intellectual property. They won't own any property. They won't have any payroll. As a matter of fact, to be called a passive investment company, they have to have zero. Under the former law, some of these companies may get a refund under the Hutchinson Technology case. Nothing we can do because we'd be passing something ex post facto. But because of the changes that were made in the law in July, on a going forward basis, the PICs will not be treated as FOCs. And to think that a, let's say, large software company in Washington would take passive investment company income and turn it into foreign operating corporation income in order to avoid the Minnesota corporate franchise tax, they would be subjecting themselves to corporate franchise tax of other states because it would no longer be in a PIC. So I would hope that there would be some degree of care taken by the Department of Revenue and the Department of Finance, not only in dealing with the refund issue, which, again, we can't do anything about ex post facto, but certainly on a going forward basis to be able to figure out what would be PIC money and what would be FOC money and to try to refine that number a little bit.
Dr. Stinson, any other comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, one of your short-term concerns on the prosecution I prayed about is the home heating cost. As I was looking at the charts, it seemed to me that Katrina, if I recall it right, was about a 15% increase over what was already quite a large increase from last year's prices. If I saw that correctly, is there any thought in terms of possible changes in whatever was causing the large increase even before Katrina? What was in play there? Is there some possibility that some of that was short term, or was another trend line that would give us trouble in the future?
Dr. Stinson.
Representative Dorn, what's going on prior to Katrina is supply and demand. We are relatively short on supply pre-Katrina in terms of natural gas, and there really isn't a quick short-term solution. LNG being imported from various places is a longer-term solution, but you have to have terminals to do that, and those terminals aren't going to be constructed for a while.
But Joe Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just
Representative Frankie.
Mr. Chairman, I have a solution for home heating costs. So, if anyone, I think
what's the phone number, Representative Frankie?
It's 651-646-7381. A high efficiency natural gas furnace will reduce your home heating costs between probably at least 15% to 25%. So I think we should look at some legislation to give consumers rebates when they purchase high efficiency gas heating equipment. So.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you out and you'll be selling corn fed? We have another use for corn now, and that is to burn it in your fireplace. But I have a question.
Or in your car.
Representative Earhart.
Forget about the beef. I don't know if I picked this out of the last time you were here or not, but either you or Mr. Gillespie said something to this effect, that in Minnesota being a high spend, high tax, high spend state, in 1950 we were 30th per capita income. 2005 we had risen to number 7 in per capita income. Somewhere I picked that out. I think I just heard it on the radio again yesterday with the latest figures that census, is the new census material out or something? Does that come out of your book or?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, those aren't numbers that I would use, but they're probably almost correct. Dr. Gillespie and I talk, we usually use from 1960 to 2004, and in 1960 we were 25th in the nation, and we were 95% of the U.S. average, and in 2004 we were 8th, and we were 109% of the U.S. average. And so we have gone on. Now, those numbers really aren't starting point or ending point sensitive. There's been a long trend that's gone on like that.
Okay. So there's something to be said for taxing well and spending well.
There's something to be said for wise investments in the future.
Representative Dorn, had you had a question?
No.
No. Oh, okay. All right. Representative Guinness? No. Okay. Commissioner, this is maybe more of a question for you, but in terms of other short-term factors, Is there anything going on with the federal government that we need to be aware of that might impact the expenditure forecast between now and February?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if we'll have more information between now and February, but we're constantly watching about what the proposals are for the medical assistance program that we have and the federal plans in that area. And we have been hearing that there's plans to look at things that would may impact revenues, but we haven't done any specific analysis of those proposals to know. Again, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that we'll have information that is more, certainly more current in February, but whether it's conclusive or not to base a change in our own forecast on then, I'm not sure.
And Commissioner, are those bills that are being discussed to settle up the federal budget year that ended on October 31st, do you know, or are those going forward items that are being discussed for the fiscal year that we're in right now?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is most of the proposals are going forward, and in fact, I think that there's a variety of proposals, some of which might mean changes in terms of the federal reimbursement to Minnesota, others that would change things that would simply reduce some eligibility and may, in effect, have savings at the state level as well.
Okay. And is Mr. Manson still here, or did he go?
I don't see him.
Otherwise, Commissioner, you don't have any knowledge as to how we're doing with the compliance revenue right now in terms of how much has come in. They were talked about the concern whether that $57 million would be there. Some months have passed since we passed that bill. How are we doing?
Mr. Chair, there were a few different components of the compliance initiatives, a couple of different proposals, but on the abusive tax shelter where we're anticipating this $57 million, none of it has come in yet.
And were we expecting some to come in by now, Commissioner?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that I'm not sure that we had a kind of specific estimate of that. It is probably more likely people would wait till approaching the deadline to actually send something in. So it may not be a concern, but it is something we'll certainly know about in another couple of months.
All right. Are there any other questions for the Commissioner or Dr. Stinson? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, do you have a recollection or figures on gas tax revenues?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I don't have that with me, but we have updated our consolidated statements, and that would show revenues in all funds, and I can make sure to review that and let you know.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Representative Weston?
I'd also like to receive that, Commissioner, and you know, perhaps everyone would, but I would.
And members, I'm reminded that we do have the minutes of Friday, May 20th before us for approval. Who would like to move the approval of those minutes?
Mr. Chairman, being that I was here for the pre-meeting, I'll move approval of the minutes.
Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, or Commissioner Ingeson, is there a place where I, as a legislator, or anyone in the general public can go to see the specificity that was utilized to make these forecast adjustments? Is there a website? Is there a number we can call? Is there a mailing address we can request that information from?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Biskins, there's the Department of Finance has a website, www.finance.state.mn, and our forecast document is there. It's a much more detailed document, 70, 80 pages, and there's a lot of information in there about the assumptions that have been made. There's also a chart that looks at all of the components of revenue to date in this fiscal year. And then the assumptions going forward. And I think hopefully that will answer most questions that you might have. If there's anything more, we'd
be happy to see what we can do.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. I think indeed it will. Appreciate it.
Representative Larson.
No.
Oh, okay. Other questions? See no other questions. Commissioner Ingeson, Dr. Stinson, thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see everyone. Have a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. The meeting's adjourned.